Welcome to Out of Bounds. I'm Tish Perlman. My guest is artist Paul McMillan. McMillan is a painter and a sculptor. He created his first piece of art at the age of five, and from the mid-1970s to the mid-1980s, he worked mostly in the realm of bronze sculptures. He began his career as a serious painter in 1984. His work has been featured in both solo and group exhibits in galleries and museums in New Mexico, Texas, Pennsylvania, as well as numerous galleries and art spaces all over the Finger Lakes region. His Day of the Dead exhibit is currently being shown at the Bakersfield Museum of Art in Bakersfield, California, and McMillan is the founder of the McMillan Art Center in Enfield, New York. Welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me. It's a pleasure to be here.
Now you say that you first discovered art trying to convince your parents that you could paint Rembrandt paintings from a book, but they never believed you. Tell us about that.
Well, it's one of my first memories of art, and really a kind of a first memory of, you know, realizing that you've had a strong feeling, and it was kind of patronized. Oh, sure, Polly, sure, Polly. And I just felt like, why don't they believe me?
And why did you think you could do that?
I have no idea, actually. I just, the pictures just drew me. I just, and they still draw me, as a matter of fact.
Yeah. But so you knew you could copy the old masters. So at age five, you actually started creating art. You did a sculpture of your pet skunk.
That's right.
To tell us what that felt like to really start.
Well, Pepe Le Pew was his name, and but in any case, it was clay. And, of course, you could just roll out and twist it into an S and put four dots on it, and you kind of had it done, you know. But at five, that's felt like quite an accomplishment, and it really was the first time that it's where I fell in love with clay, and it was really the beginning for my art endeavor. A love affair that I really haven't gotten over yet in art.
Uh-huh.
It was the start.
So your parents must have taken you somewhat seriously because you had the materials to create this skunk. Would you say Mommy and Daddy go out and get me some clay, or how did you navigate that?
I don't remember exactly, that part of it. My dad traveled the world. He was in the military, and so he had an eye for art. He loved music, and I would collect my money from my allowance a quarter a week and put it in a jar. And I remember one time I had $13.25, and I would spend it all on those sticks of clay, those four-color sticks.
Uh-huh.
And by the time I was 12, I had 50 pounds of clay. Those four-color sticks, and the big ball of clay is now gray. I don't have 50 pounds left. But over the years, all that fiddling with it, it blended into one color. Out of it would be probably 1,000 heads and all kinds of kid sculptures. And, I hid in that world. My dad, somewhere early on in the early grade school years, cut the legs off of a family table that had folding leaves that was going to go to somewhere else, and it wound up being my sculpture table. And so in that way, the support, and they sort of allowed me my introverted nature as a kid. I got over that introverted nature. But there it was, and I would sit down and think, oh, what am I going to do? And then I'd look around, it'd be 4 hours later, and I didn't want to quit.
Wow.
The call of dinner, even.
That's amazing. Now you say your introverted nature. Do you think that's what compelled you to pursue art?
I'm not sure that my introverted nature compelled me to do it, but if you're introverted by nature, you yearn to express. And any medium that you can do it, if you're timid at your root, any means will do. And somehow in that world of fantasy, I was speaking to my world. If you're shy with other kids and perhaps it's a rough and tumble world out there. I never liked that sort of thing. And so in there I could work out all my worlds and come out this world and that world. And
mm-hmm. So it was actually your way of communicating.
There's a lot of exploration there because, people would come in and check your world out, and you would, your parents would check out what you were doing there. If you were not being too kind to the other side of the table, they might correct you. On the other hand, it might be portraits and or something. And so I think at least I'm very certain they were interested in what I'm doing and allowed me to do so.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Being allowed is a word that comes into my whole life. I find wherever you're allowed and wherever even a culture allows greatness or the great times in art, from a little room to a culture, it's all because it's allowed.
Mm-hmm. But after being allowed, do you feel that you need to be encouraged?
Yes, I lived in Texas. My dad was military, so we lived in Big Spring, Texas. You could see 40 miles straight down the road. And so there wasn't a lot of visual input there. You were, you know, that's the case of such a visual climate. And then we moved to Del Rio, which was very colorful in its own way. We lived a mile from the borders. We could hear the jackasses braying at night. Uh-huh. And there was Wolfman Jack's radio station. If you had a new filling in your teeth, you could hear it in your ears like a crystal radio. And they had the Day of the Dead celebrations. A lot of color. And it's a harder culture. Rent's cheaper, and so is life. Mm-hmm. And so mm-hmm. the way they deal with it is different. And as a kid, and we lived right a block away from Dr. Brinkley's, who was on the radio, old man Brinkley, who helped people not, you know, helped him over sterility and got, it was a sham, and he got multi-millions of dollars. We lived, and then there was the Border Patrol thing. So here was this whole cultural event, and this long row of...
And you were witnessing all this and thinking about art at the same time.
There you are, and Mexico's across the border, and you have this difference of how, Dad, why are we doing okay? And you cross the border and see all these cardboard, 1,500 people live in a cardboard shack, and uh-huh. you go over there, and they're celebrating life, and you think, how can this be? You know, how, what's, and so there was always a cultural difference.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And when you move a lot, you don't, your roots, you're always new, you're always the newcomer, and seeing yeah. a new, you're seeing yourself in reflection to the difference.
Uh-huh, uh-huh. But you decided at one point to try to go to college and study art and found out college was not for you, but you continued to pursue art anyway. How did that come about?
Well, in my naivete, if you wind up, let me first say, my high school years, we lived at Possum Kingdom Lake, Texas, and it was there was only 30 people lived there. It was 15 miles to a town of 400. A school of 200 first through 12th, so we didn't exactly have a large art program, and we were removed from a lot of the daily big city behaviors. However, over in Fort Worth, 50 miles away, was the Kimball Art Museum, one of the finest museums
oh, yes.
on earth, an international museum, and dedicated to purveying that their collection and great arts from around the world to the Fort Worth community, free of charge, I might add. Combined with my dad traveling the world, I realized there was a bigger world out there. And thankfully, my parents were interested in getting us to see what we could see. So on one hand, I was in an environment culturally that didn't really have, wasn't charged with a responsibility to have art, you know, in its everyday existence. Albeit they craved it. What you don't have, sometimes you want very much.
Yes, indeed.
I think such was the case, and particularly since I rather burned for art. I remember going to the Amon Carter Museum and walking up to a William Harnett painting with a violin and different things and sheet music and a newspaper. And as I got closer, I was anxious to read the gossip of the day and the newspaper text and the painting. And when I got up there to it, of course, it was just little squigglies. It just looked like text at 10 feet. Well, when I got older and learned to write music and write it down, and then I put music in my subject matter and the text that's legible. So there you are.
So you learned a technique.
But to answer your question, uh-huh. taking all that to college, not being prepared from a rural school, going to college, I had misconceptions founded in naivete.
Mm-hmm.
I thought within the first year I would be finding out how to mix Rembrandt's mediums. seriously, and so
uh-huh, uh-huh.
academically I was not well prepared, and one thing and another. So I wound up teaching myself and learning those things.
Which is quite remarkable that you kept on it in such an incredible intensity that you were able to teach yourself all this stuff. Now, I want to ask you this. You say that you started painting seriously in 1984. How do you define that seriousness? How did you know that you were serious at that point?
I've always had the ability to sculpt. It's just a natural, what some people would call a gift. And there's many gifts, but that uh-huh. is mine, if that's the correct statement. Sculpting, I tried to be, you know, to make a living as a sculptor. Without a big name, the expense of it, learning the ropes out there, I set a world's record in going broke, no doubt.
I believe it.
Yes, but I've always been able to draw. Part of that ability is have a very accurate hand. And so I turned to painting. I didn't think, oh, I'm going to turn to painting, but it started developing, and I stumbled across a good art charcoal lesson and learned some mediums.
Mm-hmm.
In my case, really, there's an accident that happened there. One, two, three would be that in Del Rio, I had a neighbor who was a very good sculptor and painter. So he showed me how to just make a basic head. And an hour later, I brought him back a sculpted face. He was like, whoa. And in Mineral Wells, Texas, which is close to where I lived in that at that time you're asking about, where I made the thought this is the beginning of my painting career, I had a neighbor that's a classical musician. His wife was a very good portrait painter. His brother was a very good Flemish painter. So I had the good fortune to accidentally go start in clay, which is 3D, charcoal lesson, which is drawing, and then you'd paint it and glaze it. And so the accidental part of things I ran into really are like in academia, where you learn to draw, you glaze paint it, uh-huh. you have glaze painting, and then you mix paint. And
so in some ways you had more of an intimate education.
It certainly was direct. So I had access to some individuals who were accomplished at it and could get me right to the root. And I'm very interested in the technique. I believe that craft, you know, a pencil is a pencil, but you can make art with it.
Yeah, so that's a remarkable thing about just simple tools can create these amazing masterpieces. Now, I want to talk to you about the fact that you are influenced by the Dutch masters, and you learn to create paint in the same way that was created during that era. Tell us how you discovered that.
In Texas, at Fredericksburg area, where the immigrants from Germany came and settled, they brought with them toll painting, and along with it, they brought with them making medium. So in Texas, little known to this art arena, the Hudson River painters, you might say, of Texas were the Texas Hill Country painters.
Mm.
And so that medium, European technique and medium, came to life in painting through the artist and representing the landscape there. There's a great artist named Dalhart Winberg, who has been very influential on several aspects of mine. And I admired his technique. It was like Texas painted by a Dutch master. I thought, how can it be? How
That's
can
amazing.
I paint like this? It was so soft and so detailed and so smooth, like a European painting and like the Hudson River painters. Well, it was an extension of European technique. And he published a book on mediums, which gave me a first clue on the basic formulas, you know, so mm-hmm. simple, 16 ounces of stand oil and an ounce of wax and an ounce of mastic resin or copal, and you heat it like you would heat the oil to heat French fry oil to get it hot like oil, and 20 minutes later, you've got a quart of medium. It's clear paint. And
that's amazing. Well, do you think people don't use it because it's too much of a hassle to make and they just want to go buy tubes of paint?
Oh,
why would they not use that technique?
It's amazing. All the mysticism about the masters. Well, for 500 years, they only had oil and resin. Mm-hmm. They didn't have all these 10 million choices. And so those are, you reverse the properties. You take a lot of wax and add a little resin and a little oil, and you have a sculpting medium. So the fundamental things that were available for 500 years just got used in different variations. It's so easy, and you can use that medium from glaze painting. I don't use lead, let me say that.
Yeah, yeah.
And it's inert, non-toxic, mastic resin, it's from the evergreen trees, bugs don't chew on it, so that's it.
Longevity, so it also has longevity,
lasting,
yeah.
and durable. It's a yeah. totally versatile. So easy to make. I am confused why it's not the first thing. Wasn't the first thing you learned in school, because medium is the way you control a painting.
And yeah, exactly. What is it that you're attracted to in the Dutch paintings? Because I always think of the Dutch paintings, although lovely and magnificent, they're incredibly dark. The old masterpieces.
Do you mean in the colors? Or
the colors subject? Seem dark, and the shadows and the in in-betweens are so stark, it seems. I'm thinking about Rembrandt. And
if you just take Rembrandt, mm-hmm. he goes from pure black to pure white. He exercises the full spectrum. If it was a keyboard of a piano, it'd be from the far left key to the right key in his orchestration of paint. Forgive the analogy, but it gives him unlimited drama within the color spectrum.
Mm-hmm.
He exercised it. And in Rembrandt's case, I think it's true to say that there's a lot of agreement in the fact that he really expresses the spirit of the human subject in front of him, warts and all. Mm-hmm. Even if they have warts, he explained.
He did. And he put light on all of it, too. There was no shadow on
effect.
That's on the flaws.
Drama, mm-hmm. The creation of drama through the light and shadow. And then his subject matter. He was just so on the money about humanity, exposing the picture of his framer. I can stand in front of it, and I'm just stunned, because you can feel his friendship, his love of this person, the way he handles it, and the look that the person's giving him back. It's great.
If you're just joining us, my guest is artist Paul McMillan. Now, let's go back to what you were talking about, how you include lyrics often, written lyrics in some of your creations and some mm-hmm. of your paintings. What are you trying to communicate? Instead of leaving it for the imagination, you actually put messages in your paintings?
Yes, written messages. I would play my songs on my back porch. Again, my neighbor, who's a concert pianist, suggested I write them down instead of losing them. And back to that Hornet thing, I thought it would be really nice to put my original song in the painting, even if it wasn't the greatest, rather than copying Mozart, say. And so that was kind of the seminal idea of that. And I took a year and just wrote my songs and incorporated them into the subject matter, different symbols around them, to help support the notion of the lyrics and the written music. So mm-hmm. one case, I managed to add the entire song, about 8 lines of melody and lyrics. So you lose a song if you don't write it down. Forgive me if I have this wrong. There was a philosophy that I believe is rooted in Chinese philosophy, that there's a story in colors, is a painting, a voice in music. I'm forgetting what the other one is. In any case, the point of it is, I don't believe that any of the disciplines of art are separable by any particular boundary. I think they can be merged. There's a place for pure mystery. Night scenes help me with that.
And you have painted some magnificent night scenes.
Thank
they
you
are
very much.
Amazing. You think of night as black, but you add color and lyric to them.
And trying to combine the forces, then you have a theater. You think it has, you know, has pictures, a story in pictures. It has words that paint a picture, and so you have a stage at that point. It's amphiforical.
And so, do you think of a canvas as a stage?
Oh, absolutely.
Uh-huh.
When you look at my artwork, you often see still lifes are flat, things on the side. There's a backdrop, and in the center is a subject. Well, I'm, uh-huh. you know, that's
it's
getting
a perfect
close
setup
to
for a stage.
Theatrical, and I do believe that the arts. Support each other. The boundary is, it's wrong to say, okay, there's a boundary, that this is that and that. They mm-hmm. they belong together, and it's a place to pursue greatness and reflect on who and what we are, and too many subject matters to imagine.
Uh-huh. And when you're painting one of these canvases where you add lyrics, do you have the colors and the texture first, and then you add the lyrics, or are you trying to accommodate, you know, the sound of the lyrics with the color and the texture of the painting? How do you do that?
If the words paint a picture and are relative to a landscape, of a human landscape even, a whole landscape, then really the words come first and the music, and then the painting is just a way to embellish and to extend that.
Mm-hmm.
I think paintings to some extent are just an extension of what we find beautiful.
Yeah, yeah. And paintings have voices.
Yes.
Even if you're not putting lyrics inside them, yeah.
You should try to impart significant human spirit onto the surface of that painting, and it may need to have a melodic thing. You hum sometimes by yourself, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Why can't a painting represent that, too? It doesn't mean that all paintings should, but it ought to be okay in that style of painting to do that.
That's a fascinating idea. You know, I hadn't thought about that until I was reading your biography, and it was part of your philosophy. Now, I want to get to this, too. Your philosophy in regard to marketing your work. You say that you provide masterpieces surrounded by affordable works, which opens up doors in many different arenas. Talk to us about marketing.
Again, and I'm going to have to re-mention the name of Dalhart Wenberg, the most successful landscape painter that Texas will ever have, more than likely. And I was fortunate to show with him in a gallery and in another showing. And he told me 2 or 3 things in a couple of sentences, that major paintings, if you can do them, such as in the style of the old masters, if you can do them, you should. You have a talent, you ought to do it. And do your best. And then show your best. They may not sell, but it proves your talent. And then surround it with collectability to try to make your living. And, mm-hmm. you know, that way that someone comes up and they only make $6 an hour, they can't afford your major painting.
Mm-hmm.
But try to provide something everyone can enjoy. And if they really want a little work of art, make that little painting a masterpiece, a jewel-like. Make it a complete painting, not just the corner cutout. So his advice gave me that notion, that idea. And I've exercised it ever since. I realized that, so the masterpieces, they really...
Attract a museum or
well, you can do a lot of soliciting out there. Mm-hmm. This last year I did probably 40 or 50 serious solicitations and got zero from galleries. And yet then a major museum contacted me about a major painting. So they'll work for you while you're thinking, how do I go about making a living and keep this continuum going on? Because you've got to provide new and interesting work or they're going to...
Well, I think the arts needs to keep in mind that it should be there for everyone.
Oh, absolutely.
You know, I mean, I get upset about the price of tickets to opera. It used to be for the people, and now, you know, the people cannot afford it. So I see that you feel the same way about art.
Yes, it's vital to have access to that. It's about us. Art's about us.
Yeah.
It's not about something else. It's about humans.
Uh-huh. You say you want your artwork to reveal the joy of living, and yet you're starting to go back to your original Day of the Dead interest. Now, how does that connect? That's interesting to me.
Of course, my Southwestern roots, they speak to me, and celebrating life, how do you celebrate life? That's a big question. There's too many answers. The Day of the Dead celebration, it's a celebration.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And so I kind of stumbled into the painting one, and I think it's my Mona Lisa. It's unbelievably detailed. It started me down a track, started a new theme. I work in themes. Right now I'm interested in trying to do another one. It's not easy. And so when you get positive feedback, then you're also getting information. And along with information, it helps train you on what's going on out there. In effect, it builds on itself. One thing leads to another in the simplest of terms. And having a Southwestern background, an early experience with it, those things, your first experiences are laying idle in you, waiting to... And over the years, even though you don't think of them every day, they are who you are.
They're
your foundations.
Waiting to surface again. Uh-huh.
It's easy to go back to your foundation. It's very familiar within you. It's ingrained. So you don't have to learn it all over like a new subject matter, which is, of course, good to do also.
So you're saying Day of the Dead was lying dormant in you, and it has
surfaced. For example, my dad would take me over into Old Mexico, which is only a mile away, as I said before. And we'd go to a cantina there, Ma Crosby's, and he would pay someone to go get a cantina guitarist, particularly this old silver-haired fellow. And my dad would sit there and have a few cool beers, as many men of his military, and smoke a couple of cigarettes, and we'd watch life go by. And so it felt very natural. In the Day of the Dead things, you celebrate the dearly departed. You bring them back to you in remembrance and celebrate them that way.
Uh-huh.
And some would say it's macabre. Perhaps.
I've always found it quite fascinating.
I find it vastly fascinating.
Uh-huh.
And it's a way of reconnecting with your thoughts about someone and their experience, and also giving them a little bit of, in your own fantasy brain, allowing them to be the things they wanted to be in their life. Letting them, if they yearn to be, then in the Day of the Dead, you also often let them do so in the little diorama you make for them to celebrate them.
Uh-huh.
If they were in that painting there, before I knew it, I had really made a celebratory piece of artwork in reference to my dad. He loved guitar music, and the symbols in there that wound up being chosen were very much the same symbols as to what he was about, and I'm absolutely certain that I didn't consciously choose them. I must say that my sweetheart, the love of my life, Susanna Berryman, is always willing to help me set up a diorama. That's one of the advantages of living with
because
a
because she's theater a theater person. Yeah.
Uh-huh. Yes, you have an expertise in...
figuring out how to fill the stage.
Yes, if you want to build a stage, I have great help there. So I must give credit there.
And so you have an exhibit at the Bakersfield Museum of Art now. That's quite an accomplishment in itself.
I'm very happy about that. And let me... when you introduced it, it almost sounded like it was my show. I'm just a participating member in the show. And their museum evidently is mandated, dedicated by mission to bring art from all over to educate their public. So they run three concurring shows at one time. And to be asked to participate is a wonderful thing. They did look me up and found my artwork on the web, which again fulfilled that idea. If you do good work and put it out there, someone will find you. So by participating with them, I'm thrilled to be a part of a major exhibition, which is to celebrate the Day of the Dead.
And I love it. I love
it. In Bakersfield, they have a strong... but they're not that far from it's integral to their culture, so I'm really grateful to be in that show.
Yeah, wonderful. Now, before we run out of time, I want to talk to you about the Macmillan Center, the Macmillan Art
Yes.
Center that you
mm-hmm.
created. Tell us about it.
Well, 10 years ago, I'd owned an old schoolhouse in Bellefonte, Pennsylvania, before I moved here, and I really enjoyed having a large box of a building to have my artwork all up in. It's great to have it showing. And when most of the time you wait for the opportunity to show your work. And I primarily bought it as a studio, but I also realized that it would serve as a multi-purpose facility. I could show my work. I could do exhibits when it was possible to do so, mm-hmm. and have room for dances and theater and concerts.
And then this is in Enfield?
In Enfield. It's about 7 miles from Ithaca.
Mm-hmm.
We've had our first year here. I intend on staying in business here as long as I possibly can. I love the building. We've had two concerts and five dances and two call of entry type art shows, all of which were successful. We're kind of holding our own at this point, holding our breath in the economy, hoping that we can continue. This year I didn't do showings through the summer. I was fortunate enough to get six commissions that I had to fulfill and some other part-time. I picked up a little part-time work, too, to help through things in these times. So I didn't have the privilege of time to do the call for entry shows, mm-hmm. which you have to set the whole show. So I hope mm-hmm. to continue that in the future.
And, great.
And I want to invite everybody to, there's many more uses for that old building. And
which brings me, we are almost out of time. Can you give them some contact information so that they can get in touch with you about this?
The Macmillan Art Center is, of course, MacmillanArtCenter.com. And you can go online and see what we're basically doing there. Offer suggestions. Come out and visit us. Invent your own reality if you want to work it out there. We're artists. We're easy to get along with. It's peaceful out there. You don't have to turn the noise off. You have to turn noise on. You can't necessarily get that in town. And I'm making a joke here, but you might have to suffer through 7 miles of beautiful country to actually come out there. But once you do, the old building's 150 years old. It's beautiful.
It is gorgeous.
I
went to one of your early exhibits there. I'd recommend people check it out. And check Paul Macmillan's work out, too. It's just gorgeous stuff. Paul Macmillan, thank you so much for joining us.
It's my extreme pleasure. Thank you very much.
Our audio producer is Nate Richardson at Rep Studio in Ithaca, New York. If you'd like to make a tax-deductible donation in support of the Out of Bounds radio show, please contact our fiscal sponsor, the Arts of the Southern Finger Lakes, at earts.org. That's earts.org. Our theme music was composed by Diego Vega. And visit us online at outofboundsradioshow.com. We'll be back next week. I'm Tish Perlman.